it, boy. Going down the road feeling bad. I'm going down the road feeling bad. Going down the road feeling bad. And I ain't going to be treated this way.
Life wasn't easy for Monomus Lavina Gibson Andrus.
I'm going to venture a guess that being named Monomus Lavina Gibson Andrus didn't help.
Shh, I'm setting the stage.
Sorry.
Life wasn't easy for Monomus What's-Her-Face. She was born in Mississippi in 1842 and was barely 4 years old when her family converted to Mormonism and took the little girl all the way across the plains. And unfortunately, they didn't make it to Utah because they got stuck in Pueblo, Colorado on their way because Levina's pa caught the typhoid fever. Apparently, this was a really traumatic experience for Levina. Levina. We don't know what happened. We don't know how to pronounce her name. We just knew that she would mention to any person throughout her life that the horrors of her experience during that time resulted because she and her mother and sisters were the only, quote, women folk there among a sea of rough men. But I should point out, though, that she does later recollect that there were Spanish women at the fort that were very kind to her, had very clean floors, made very good bread. But I'm guessing Levina believed that white women were the only real women folk.
So check out this story from her family history. Quote, one night during the long Pueblo winter, several of the men were gambling in a building adjacent to that occupied by the Gibson family when an argument arose over the card game. One of the men was killed, and Grandma relates that she could hear the gunfire of the men who pursued the murderer, who was later apprehended, shot to death, and, as her father was a carpenter, from some rough logs he fashioned a coffin in which the murderer was buried.
I gotta say, getting killed in a card game with a pine box coffin is peak Old West.
It kind of seems like this is an Old West branded version of Clue. Where'd he get killed? Well, see, he got killed in the card game with a pine box coffin.
I love it. Made out of rough-hewn logs.
The dad was a carpenter. He made it happen, so. So because the family is resting in Pueblo, they then join up with Captain Brown's Mormon battalion detachment that's headed back to Utah. Levina's family traveled with them and arrived 1 week after Brigham Young's Vanguard Company had just rolled into the valley.
So even though she was really young, those first few years in Utah left another scar in Levina's memory. As we're going to talk about now, yay, a new season. We're out of winter quarters. Early Utah territory was rough potatoes. I mean this literally. They grew potatoes and it was rough. Just all of it. A rough time to live. Rough time to eat potatoes, if you had potatoes at all. And sadly, they had to devote most of that first crop to funeral potatoes. Okay, fine, not really, but funerals. I feel like that works. Funerals or potatoes, just not together. However, there were a lot of deaths. Why did I even make that joke? That's such poor taste.
It really was.
There's not even like cheese to make it better.
There's no cornflakes anywhere in the valley. Listen, as long as I don't have to talk about babies dying, we can definitely proceed. To make matters worse, Levina's mother was an invalid. The family had an uphill battle from the get-go. They, of course, are some of the earliest Mormons to move into the North Fort that we talked about last time. Levina's life would be filled with challenges. She first marries Lot Huntington, which is a challenge in and of itself, I'm guessing. Then when he died in early 1860s, she and her sister would become plural wives to James Andrus.
Wait, is Lot Huntington the guy that Joseph F. Smith hated?
Cornelius Lott.
Oh, okay. That's not too many Lotts. But she marries James Andrus, which is not Milos Andrus, right? Because, man, I want to smack that guy in the face with a proverbial shovel. And we'll talk more about James Andrus later on, because he becomes a prominent colonizer and pioneer, and Juanita Brooks finds his diary, and it's really cool. He would move his family down to southern Utah, where he settled Grafton, Utah.
Ghost town alert.
Isn't that where they filmed like a lot of the Hollywood movies in Grafton?
Yeah, that's one of the more famous ones.
So Hollywood, we have James Andrus to thank for that. In less ghostly famous Hollywood news, Levina would be blind about the last two decades of her life, which greatly depressed her. But the entire reason we are introducing you to Levina has to do with when she was a young child. Because now, about 5 years old, her eyes are working. She arrives in the Salt Lake Valley a week after Brigham Young.
As we mentioned last time, the very day the Mormons arrive in the valley, they start to plant crops. They put in a wheat crop, some grain, barley, potatoes, and a whole lot of sadness. Levina's family gets settled. Right away, they noticed an infestation of all kinds of critters. Mice just flocking around their homes and campgrounds. Coyotes, wolves, foxes, and bugs. So many bugs. And honestly, I feel like I could have more compassion on my ancestors if they would have just eradicated mosquitoes then when they had a chance. Such quitters.
The first winter in the valley was tough. The people were getting used to new plants and new ways of living. Thankfully, the weather was unseasonably warm that year, but it was pretty wet. Parley P. Pratt wrote, quote, "Nearly every house leaked during the first winter, and umbrellas were such a luxury as an umbrella was owned, were frequently in demand to shelter those engaged in cooking."
Listen, ma'am, we get it. Umbrellas plus cooking equals terrible. And I agree. For Christmas that year, they gathered sagebrush for fire. I don't even know what song that was going to be. It's a Christmas carol. That's what it is.
Sagebrush and Christmas.
It's one.
Sage on the hearth and crickets in the pot. I don't know.
Charles Lowell Walker somewhere, I'm sure, has the text to this crappy, crappy Christmas song.
Gray mice roasting on an open fire.
See, there we go. We just needed a minute. Because they didn't have stoves for everybody, they just kind of did brush fires. And obviously, as we talked about, food is scarce. Some saints talk about smuggling in extra wheat, but they're Mormon, so of course they feel guilty for not sharing, and they give it up for planting instead. There was little to eat, so they hunted rabbits. The Christmas Sabbath was the only celebration they had that year. I mean, honestly, this is like the crappiest Christmas ever. I'm surprised there isn't like a Deseret Book Christmas, like a kid's book about this.
You know, we could extract so much sadness and persecution from this first Christmas.
I mean, this is honestly like this is a lost opportunity.
Oh, I hope you like the orange in your stocking. Grandpa had to eat a badger for Christmas.
Grandpa got bark. Bunch of bark. So, the Mormons of the Valley gathered around the flagpole that was erected, saying, "Come, come, ye saints," and then ate boiled rabbit and a little tiny bit of bread. So the next time you think your family Christmas party sucks, maybe just kind of envision this scene and the taste of boiled rabbit in your mouth.
I will say, you know they were imbibing whiskey, so at least they had whiskey. Does your family party have whiskey? No.
Sometimes.
I'd take boiled rabbit over no whiskey at family parties, I'm just saying. It's really during the spring that things get really, really rough. The Mormons were really, really, really cross your fingers hopeful that the seeds that they had planted starting that first July 24th would give them something to eat that year. But unfortunately, a terrible war swept over the land. First, a brutal frost that killed the crops. But that was nothing compared to the Great Mormon Cricket War.
You said crickets? Yes?
Indeed. The Mormons faced their biggest foe yet. Missouri nothing. Extermination order nothing. Swarms of shield-back katydid crickets invaded the Mormons and gave off a good fight. The crickets devastated the crop that the Mormons needed to survive. They threatened to eat all the crops and starve out the Mormons. Thomas Kane recalled that Mormons called these crickets Black Philistines. An early settler, Anson Call, described them as, "It has an eagle eye staring appearance that suggests the idea that it may be the habitation of a vindictive little demon."
I don't pity Anson Call, because if he knew where the Mormons were going to settle that far back, couldn't he have figured out a way to battle the crickets? I digress. The Mormons weren't going to take this one sitting down, especially young Levina. At 5 years old, Levina became a brave soldier in Uncle Brigham's army. They give her a wooden mallet, along with all the other kids in the valley, and they spend the entire late spring smashing and beating the living hell out of those nasty crickets. And I have to say that my inner 5-year-old thinks that actually sounds pretty rad. Honestly, my current more than 5-year-old self is pretty much on board still.
Do you know how big those MFers are? Like, that would make a sound every time you did it. They're large. They're like inches large.
Cockroachy size.
Yeah. And they're like crunchy. So like you're whacking them and it's disgusting.
I think as a kid, I'm pro Levina. I'll sign me up for Uncle Brigham's Army.
I don't know. I would cry when my family went crawdad fishing. And then my cousins would chase me around with their little claws after they ate them. I think I would have felt bad for the crickets.
I mean, it was a serious fight. The crickets were no sissies. They took a lot of their crops, but the crickets were not on God's side, clearly.
That's right. The crickets might have won the battle, but they would lose the Great Mormon Cricket War. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Lindsay, did you know that Avraham Gileadi's name can be translated, "One of these is not like the others"?
You lying liar. His story was a little different, though, wasn't it? In the single month of September 1993, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints excommunicated or disciplined six of its members. These six individuals, some of them intellectuals, some activists, and some both, were dubbed the September 6th. In September 6th and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism, Sarah M. Patterson challenges readers to think more deeply about the events of that month and the era in which they unfolded. Patterson argues that the clever, alliterative phrase September 6th masks our ability to see that what happened that month was part of a much broader, decades-long cultural and theological debate over the nature of the church and its restoration narrative. During those decades, the institutional church invested in and policed a purity system, expecting believers to practice doctrinal, familial, and bodily purity. Dissenters within the institution pushed back, imagining instead a vision of the restoration that embraced personal conscience, truth-seeking and telling, and social egalitarianism at its core. Both sides were profoundly shaped by the cultural milieu that surrounded them. What happened in September 1993 continues to echo in the church today, having lasting effects on the institution, its believers, and the broader culture. The September 6th and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism by Sarah M. Patterson, new from Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books or the ghost of Michael Quinn will cut off your endnotes.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel like I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Now, we don't have records, but I'm just gonna guess. I'm just going to make an assumption that if I were the Utes or the Shoshones watching the Mormons with their mallets, I might be a little amused, maybe even confused. Because for centuries, indigenous people had used these crickets and other bugs like grasshoppers, who had waged their own separate war against Mormons the next year, as food sources. Archaeologists have discovered that prehistoric peoples in the Great Basin sun-dried crickets and then ate them. I mean, you can buy chapulines, which are roasted grasshoppers, right now at the Mariners Stadium. Guessing Brigham Young would see that and think, too soon.
Shoshone, Goshute, and Paiute long lived on these insects as a primary food source. They would roast them and ground them into meal for cake and mush, and apparently they were said to be as sweet as sugar.
It's really interesting to learn how these different tribes used these as a food source. Southern Paiutes would drive large swarms of them into trenches filled with dried grass and then light it on fire. Other tribes would build these willow branch brooms and scoop them up into baskets and then take them home to roast. Apparently, the cakes that were made by their sugar were something pioneers called desert fruit cake.
It's hilarious to me that Mormons are starving. Actually, no, I mean, like, it's not funny that Mormons are starving, but these bugs were packed with proteins and carbs and what could have been a blessing, like having all this manna from heaven invade their crops. Mormons saw as a plague. What a metaphor. Let that be a lesson to you, listeners. Sometimes God gives you crickets, and if you have the right attitude, you'll turn them into sugar.
Okay, so you're saying that if somebody gives you cases of Tim Ballard books, then what you really have is firewood for days? I gotcha. I see how this system works. See, the problem was, though, is Mormons didn't want cricket sugar. They decided to just attack them in earnest. There were all kinds of approaches to kill them. They, like we said, sent kids to whack them. That's a popular one. Bill Hartley, who we pull a lot from for this, said, quote, "The harassed farmers prayed and fought and prayed for almost 2 weeks against the dumpy crickets, which some Mormons jokingly described as a cross between the spider and the buffalo."
What I've learned in all of this is that sometimes we paint the crickets in our lives as villains, but they're really the heroes in disguise. The proverbial Jesus, dressed as an unhoused person sitting on a bench waiting to test us.
See, what I've learned from all this is the fact that no baseball team in Utah has ever been named the Crickets, and that is a giant, yearning missed opportunity.
For nearly all the spring, the Crickets threatened the Mormons. Governor Boggs nothing. These Crickets were given a good fight.
Can we at least call them Boo Hiss Crickets?
Yeah, I feel like we have to. In the spirit of consistency, let me try that again. For nearly all spring, the crickets threatened the Mormons. Governor Boggs boo hissed nothing. These boo hiss crickets were giving a good fight. How's that? It was bleak. Where acres of farm were supposed to be covered in green, fertile blossoms for harvest of winter wheat and potatoes, instead, the fields were covered in black, gross swarms of spider buffaloes. It's almost as if the Mormons, I don't know, needed a miracle.
Hang down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now.
We could tell you what happens next, but I don't know. I just don't think we could do it justice.
Instead, we're going to let a folk song titled The Seagulls and the Crickets, written by an anonymous person, sung by L.M. Hilton, get it done. This version is performed by Dwayne Hyatt, Dennis Sorensen, and Dick Davis, known as the 3Ds. Don't you worry, we will definitely be throwing the link up on the site because we know you're going to want to put this in your summer playlist.
And threaten the pioneer. But spring with her smiling skies sent grace and cheer to the hosts within. And they tilled their fields with newborn hope and the courage to fight and win.
Then crickets by tens of thousands came, like fog on a British coast. The finger of devastation marked its course on the Mormon host.
Then seagulls feathered in angel white, and angels they were forsooth. They too by the thousands came to battle in very truth.
They charged down upon the cricket hordes, engorging them day and night. They routed the devastating foe, and the crickets were put to flight.
All heads were bowed as they thanked their God, and they reaped while the devil raved. The harvest was garnered to songs of praise, and the pioneers were saved.
Yeah, that's a catchy little ditty there.
Well, in case you didn't catch it, the seagulls saved the day. They were the greatest miracle Utah has seen since T.J. Haas just barely missed a talk with his bishop by telling the crowd to shut the F up.
That's right. Those seagulls swooped in and droves to rescue the poor pioneers.
All I'm saying is, the seagulls saved more children than Timothy Ballard. Bada bum.
See, I don't know. I think Sean Reyes would actually petition to make Ballard our state bird.
And wouldn't it be such a handsome bird? Piercing blue eyes and Captain Moroni vibes.
But would it puke up cricket rejects, though?
I'm sorry.
Oh, did we forget to mention this part? Because the seagulls would come and eat a ton of these bugs, and then, because they had bad table manners, would throw them back up again. Eat and puke. Eat and puke. It's the great miracle of the Mormon pioneers.
There's a metaphor in there somewhere for sure.
Because seagulls are nature's morons, and you know what I'm talking about. They put all sorts of crap in their mouth. Then they have to regurgitate the parts their stomachs can't digest. You know, like cricket exoskeletons. They puke out these little pellets called bolus. And of course, Mormons were like, they are eating and throwing it up just for us. Every time they throw up, they're eating more crickets. They're puking just for us. The Lord has provided a way.
Wow, that's just so special. We are God's chosen people. This is such a beautiful, heartwarming story, and I hope you're all writing this down because I expect y'all to bear your testimonies about this on Sunday. Write it down. Bolus, B-O-L-U-S.
It really is an incredible modern-day miracle. Except too bad it isn't true.
A good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go home with you?
So the folk song is great, yeah? And so are those adorable 3Ds. They actually have turned a lot of Mormon songs into folk songs, which is really the only acceptable way to hear them. But the words of the folk song are lies? Dun dun dun. How can it be, Brian?
I know. I'm shocked that a benign farm joke got turned into a myth. It's never happened before in Mormonism.
All right, I gotta tell you about an experience I had. I was invited by the Haight family to go to the reinterment of Isaac Haight. Isaac Haight was exhumed in Arizona. He was there in hiding because he ordered the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and he dies in Arizona and is buried there. Turns out he was dug up four times. But anyway, his family paid money to reinter him in Cedar City with his four wives. I went to go watch this whole thing. They allowed me to film it for a doc project that we're working on, and there was an old Mormon patriarch who told us a story, a farm story, that I would like to share with you today because it reminds me of this. He told us that this is a very common farm story. It's not one that I had heard, but apparently it's very common in southern Utah. So raise your hands out there if you've heard this. I'm not going to talk about the appropriateness of him, saying this during a reinterment memorial service for Isaac Haight, who was, in
An
charge
upstanding
of,
man? Is that what you're going to say?
He was the first mayor of Cedar City, and he ordered the deaths of at least 120 people. But here's the story. The guy goes, so on the farm, there was this pig and the chicken, and the pig and the chicken were arguing who had more worth on the farm. And the chicken said, I have more worth because I show up consistently every day. And the pig said, no, 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 I'm more important on the farm because I'm full commitment. And I was sitting there going, and like everyone laughed, and I was like, I don't think I get it. Cause like clearly, like it can't be what I think that, like, he didn't make a slaughter joke during a Mountain Meadows massacre event, but he did. Yeah, no, that's the point. that's what we get from these old farm jokes. So yeah, I can see why this folk song, Seagulls and Crickets, exists. We have these old farm people who kill animals like to come up with crazy, crazy jokes about it, I guess.
Well, yeah, then I guess this is one of those examples where you take a weird agricultural thing and make it weirder. So, but thanks to the great work of historian Bill Hartley, he pretty much debunked this myth. We will definitely link his article in the show notes as well.
So let's go over the bullet points of why the seagull cricket, the miracle of the gulls is what they're calling it, story has been debunked. Right out the gate, we'll debunk the myth that Brian mentioned that gulls were throwing up crickets to eat more crickets and help the Mormons out. It's just how seagulls eat.
You mean nature's morons?
Nature's morons. They really are, though. Like, I love that they're Utah State Bird. There's a metaphor in there as well. They weren't doing it on purpose. They just eat bugs and discard what they can't eat, like eating a sunflower seed. Now, that doesn't debunk the miracle, but because, like, what if God knew that the Mormons needed a bird like that? So he sent them out to the desert to help these Mormons. I mean, come on, Brian, what were seagulls doing in the middle of the desert anyway? Seagulls are by the ocean. Seagulls had never been here before.
Ooh, hey there. What's wrong? It's another fallacy Bill Hartley points out, because seagulls had long been in Utah.
Damn it, Grandpa Weiss, with our good bedtime stories he would give me. Why didn't you tell me seagulls have always been here?
Have you heard of the Great Salt Lake, Grandpa Weiss? Because it's a large body of, you know, salt water. Yeah, Utah had seagulls. They didn't come just for this one specific occasion.
So if you notice the song, there's this line about seagulls in 1849. But wait, didn't the crickets come in 1848?
Yeah, here's another myth. The cricket infestation had already caused severe damage in 1848. When the gulls show up almost a whole year later, the damage is already done. By then, the crops were also damaged by frost, and now here comes an impending drought, just for good measure.
And some people say the seagulls didn't even come at all. Some pioneer accounts don't ever even mention them. And if they did, it wasn't really miraculous, because even in 1848, the gulls might show up here and again to eat food. They were already here. They came and went like normal birds and were not a rare occurrence. Very few accounts saw large armies of seagulls swoop in. Most didn't even see them at all.
And this is probably why most of contemporary accounts didn't see it was a miracle until later. Orson Hyde would declare the event a miracle in General Conference in October 1853.
Big surprise there. Orson Hyde turning something into a big myth.
Quote, the hand of Providence prepared agents and sent them to destroy the destroyer, a circumstance that was rare, one that was never known to exist before and never since to any extent. All right, Hyde, why don't you calm down? Why don't you talk about the baby resurrection some more, huh?
There are some other stories that fostered the legend, and I found a great thesis that I'm going to link by Amy Williamson, who covers some accounts of this event. She's actually writing about Minerva Tychart's work, but she says some journals equated the seagulls with saviors. They called them sacred birds. So you call them dummies.
Nature's morons.
But pioneers called them sacred birds and wrote it as divine deliverance. Orson Whitney says the crickets were, quote, an army of famine and despair, defeated by white gulls. To him, according to Williamson, this was a battle between the hosts of heaven and hell.
Oh, geez, Orson Whitney being over the top with poetic language? Boy, that's a shocker. One of my favorite Orson Whitney stories, he writes this long epic poem called Elias, and he basically forces all of his friends to sit there and listen to the whole thing. It had to have taken hours. And Not a lot of glowing reports and diary accounts of it, so yeah, this does not surprise anyone.
The Orsons, really good at embellishment.
So in Amy's thesis, she writes that Austin Fife, one of the absolute legends in documenting Mormon folklore, interviewed Mrs. Annie P. Roberts in 1945. At this point, she's 85 years old. Her account of the event of the seagulls says, quote, "There was the grasshoppers. Mormon crickets came and stripped their fields. They came and were stripping their fields of all the grain that was ready for the harvest. The grasshoppers just alighted overnight. They just made the sky black. Then the seagulls came. They came up and ate the grasshoppers in the fields, and then they would go to the lake and vomit them up and come back up and eat more until they were all driven away. If not for them, the pioneers would have starved."
And here's the thing. The grasshoppers and crickets are actually separate. Grasshopper infestation comes a couple of years later, but whatever. An interesting thing in Amy Williamson's thesis is that she notes the accounts are a little gendered, and I love it when people point this out. So women often talked about the event, saying the seagulls were saviors that stopped them from death and starvation. Here's what Amy writes. She says, quote, "This differs significantly from the male perspective, as one pioneer man named John Smith reported this incident in a letter to Brigham Young, in which he stated that it was the efforts of the Mormons and the seagulls that saved their crops. Some of these efforts were very creative. One attempt was driving the crickets into ditches and burying them. Others tried to keep them airborne by waving sheets in their fields. And others used rollers to smash the insects. One particular method was to make a pile of straw to attract the crickets. Once the pile was covered, a torch was set, burning millions of insects."
I'm sure the weird pyro kids in the neighborhood are like, "Ooh, I like this idea."
Did you ever have that kid in your neighborhood? And God forbid, I hope no one listening was that kid, but like liked to pull off the wings of butterflies and like torture.
Yeah, it's that kid.
You got this from your great-great-grandfather. During the Great Cricket War, the trauma continues.
Amy brings up another story collected from the Fifes, who got the non-Mormon perspective also. She says they interviewed Judge Charles Schofield in 1946, and he's 93 at this point. Schofield was a non-Mormon judge who presided in Utah during the late 19th century. He told the Fifes, quote, "Many people went out there and they scratched the soil and sowed grain. The grasshoppers came down and was about to eat up everything in sight. Brigham Young, called upon the Almighty for help, and the Almighty sent those gulls down there, and the gulls filled up on the grasshoppers and then went down and filled up with salt water at the lake and threw it all up, and then came back and filled up with grasshoppers again." Do you like my judge voice? That was pretty judgy.
That was really good. I like, you know, there's so much like bulimia in these seagulls. Like, wow, trigger warnings all around.
Yeah. I did enjoy that the Fifes noted, quote, "It was evident from Judge Schofield's manner that he did not believe the story." Nice job, Judge.
So one more good thing from Williamson's work, which again, you have to check it out. It's mostly about Minerva Tykart's work. It's filled with a lot of good stuff. So I don't know if you've ever heard about the Teton Dam disaster in Idaho in the 1970s. Have you been there? Have you ever done that?
Mm-mm.
So maybe it's because I married into an Idaho family, but you can drive up there. It's really sad. Like, you can still see the trees. Basically, this dam burst in the 1970s, and it killed a lot of people. It was a tragedy. But there was this Mormon woman who was there, Mrs. Hansen, who was, you know, involved in this and who was being interviewed by the newspaper, by the Herald Journal, about her experience there. And she actually brings up the seagull and cricket allegory and compares it to the dam. This is what she says, quote, "Each day at dawn, I hear the seagulls cry as they come to the fields between River Heights and Providence. I almost feel like I should stand at attention and sort of say a little prayer for the safety of these, our state birds. I recall my grandparents telling how the many crickets came in swarms, which nearly darkened the sun. The seagulls saved the crops for the Utah settlers. After the Teton Dam disaster and the floodwaters had subsided, there were countless ponds and pools left where the mosquitoes had a holiday. The ponds were full of their larvae and epidemics were feared from the mosquitoes. And then the gulls came. They lighted on ponds and pools, and in a week, all larvae and mosquitoes were gone. Miracles still happen."
I mean, I'll admit it, I'm just salty about seagulls. Like, you hear stories about crows playing chess or checkers or whatever, and I'm like, seagulls that get through the day without running into each other in the air, like, that's a win for them.
Have you ever like walked the smelly shores of the Great Salt Lake and there's just so many dead seagulls like just laying around? My thing is, okay, great, they save all these people, but I lived in Tooele County for 12 freaking years and I could not go to a t-ball game without coming home looking like I had smallpox. Like, the mosquitoes were so bad, where were they for us?
Running into each other in the air. Nature's morons. I'm serious. Okay. However, stuff like this is interesting because this is exactly how myth and legends develop. Because humans are meaning-making animals. And sometimes we like to laugh at these stories about how memory works, but we shouldn't, because it's normal for humans to understand this path with stories like this. And I think the difference of when it starts to become a problem is when we think that myth and history are the same thing, because they aren't.
Yeah, as a storyteller myself, I understand the archetypes here for a good miracle story, right? You've got these black, gross, spidery enemy crickets, and then you have these white winged angel birds, Moses-y promised land inspa with rows of crops and sacrifice and plague and starvation. But there's also this other archetype that shows the sort of Anglo supremacy that Mormons had. Again, I just want to say this. They could have eaten the crickets.
I mean, geez, they could eat the birds too. They're dumb. They're easy to catch. They're starving. They had all this protein flown into them locally and then other protein walking right up to the pantry door. So why didn't they just eat them?
I'm going to go with racism.
Can you be racist towards crickets? I mean, I personally am super racist towards mosquitoes, but...
I think that's speciesist. No, I mean, you'll see Mormon accounts about indigenous Utah bands being judged for being lowly because they ate these bugs. So the ghost shoots, we talked about them last episode, for example, were given the name meant to be derogatory called Digger Indians, digging because they subsided on digging for roots and bugs, but also it was a nod towards the N-word. So there were plenty of food sources when Mormons arrived in the valley, and Mormons didn't know how to utilize them, and so friendly Shoshone and Utes tried to show the Mormons how to do it, and the Mormons refused. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to rant about this for a minute. Permission to rant?
Permission granted.
Okay, so because later on in the Utah period, you'll see a Mormon effort to encourage native bands to farm. So this is like Brigham Young and John D. Lee saying, like, look, we're trying to help these lowly Indians. If they just learned to farm, then they wouldn't be so lowly. So Paiutes especially are impacted by Mormon disruption, and they do start to starve. So Mormons see that as a sign of weakness and try to teach them to farm. So they established things sort of like early reservations to teach them to farm. Indian farms, Corn Creek was a famous one. And there are so many accounts of Mormons being frustrated by Indians for not being successful at farming. And they would call them lazy because they didn't want to do it. And it reinforces this idea to everyone that Indians are stupid and lazy and don't want to get help that was given to them.
Why can't they just be white like us?
Why can't they just farm and do our things? But geez, like, from their perspective, they did the same thing to the Mormons in the late 1840s. When the Mormons arrived, they try to show the Mormons how to live here and prosper and eat the plants and eat the animals. And Mormons were like, ew, gross, no.
No, we're going to eat our bark soup, thank you. Yeah, it's like with the history of why tobacco is legal, but the devil's lettuce is not. By the time marijuana has been introduced to largely white people in America, tobacco is this viable cash crop in the South. Tobacco is linked with this myth of Southern wealth and gentility, but marijuana is from the global South. It's introduced by Mexicans, other indigenous tribes, and it's seen as the poor man's leaf, which is, of course, a brown person's leaf. Tobacco, which I think you can argue is more dangerous than weed, is seen as legal because it's been marketed as wealthy and cool by white people. But weed is tainted by racism. It's introduced, of course, by brown people, and that immediately is seen as lesser.
And the story of Mormons in the valley is the same. Like, they're starving, yes, but they didn't have to. Eating bugs was seen as lowly. It wasn't dignified. Mormons came into Utah thinking that they were going to improve upon it. And here's another rant. Do you want to know why white people have the joke that they can't eat spicy food? So there's this anthropological theory that white people come from caves in the north, so they didn't get a lot of spices to preserve their food. They could freeze them. There was a lot of snow. They could freeze their meat. And that's true. Places that have spicy food usually rely on hot peppers to preserve their food. If you go to India, the reason why food is so hot is because the hot peppers preserve the food. People with ice and caves could freeze it. So when white people interacted with indigenous food, they did everything they could to make it bland, because blandness was associated with whiteness. You wanted to take the wildness out of the meat. You literally wanted to take the gamey meat taste and make it taste like nothing, because wildness and gaminess is the taste of wildness, indigenous people. So cover it up with gravies and sauces if you must. Use some salt and mild spices. But spicy spices were from the global south, and there's just some racism there.
Hey, listen, I enjoy spicy crickets. Or maybe, you know, crickets covered in cheese that you can buy at Hot Licks.
Do you eat those? Did you ever eat those?
I've never had that.
The Hot Licks stuff?
It sounds entertaining.
I'm going to buy some for your kids.
Okay, fine.
Like, they're really fun. You can be like sour cream crickets, sour cream and onion crickets, cheesy crickets. Then they're just sweet. They're sweet like white sugar. But the whole point of these rants is that Mormons could have had a lot fuller stomachs those first few years if they weren't racist. They were willing to shoot foxes and squirrels. Fine. And that was more civilized to them than these roasted crickets. And again, I'm sure there's a metaphor in that as well.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. What was good enough?
Hot summer streets and the pavements are burning. I sit around, trying to smile, but the Books of Mormon's report is so heavy and dry. Powered by Benchmark Books. Sorry to say, folks, but the books have been kidnapped, leaving us with the articles and theses of Mormon's report. Once again, this podcast recommends saying the word theses as often as possible, at least once a day for health reasons. If it's not driving with you, maybe try some coffee. Oh, geez. LHP is shaking her head. No more poop jokes. Back to work. Okay. Good old Bill Hartley. We miss that guy. His article in the Utah Historical Quarterly, Mormons, Crickets, and Gulls, A New Look at an Old Story, is an absolute gem. What's interesting, that was actually pre-Arrington. That was 1970. This is the best place to get a better hands on this folklore tale. Like Bill was wont to do, he could revise your history so sneakily you didn't even notice he was doing it. It's very good. And then, like Lindsay mentioned, even though the thesis is really about Minerva Tykert, crickets sneak in there. Don't they always? Storytelling through brushstrokes, Minerva Tykert's visualization of the Mormon pioneer experience and messages to her audience, written by Amy Williamson. Billy Burroughs, I was good enough. Poor Billy Burroughs, I was good enough. Poor Billy Burroughs.
So send avenging angels, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. Won't you send destroying Jainites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.